Welcome to Uprising, Matilda Bernstein Sycamore.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back on the show.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's talk about the premise of this book that you have edited and what exactly you mean when you talk about the way in which gay culture, LGBT culture, it becomes and has become more and more assimilated, become more and more corporatized, exactly.
Exactly, yes. So I would say that gay culture has become obsessed with normalcy at any cost. And so that's how you see things like marriage and military inclusion and adoption and child rearing. You know, the sort of the dominant signs of straight conformity are now seen as the ultimate signs of gay success. And so, you know, so gay culture is sort of obsessed with consumerism at the same time. So things like Pottery Barn and Peck implants and Absolut Vodka and Diesel jeans and, you know, even absurd things like Rainbow Hummers, you know, are now marketed to a sort of gay consumer identity. And what's been lost are the foundational values of gay liberation. So gay liberation, in its initiation, fought for the end of organized religion, the end of the nuclear family, the end of the militarized state, and argued for sexual and social and political self-determination, not just for queers, but for everyone.
Now, you say in the introduction to this book that you've edited that the book, Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots, is an emergency intervention. And it is also a deeply personal project for me. Why is it so personal?
Yeah, well, so as a genderqueer faggot and a queen, you know, I find myself intensely inspired by transgender, gender nonconforming, genderqueer cultures. You know, I'm really inspired by the politics and the potentials and the worlds and communities that people are creating. But simultaneously, I find myself in male sexual spaces, you know, that are obsessed with mandatory masculinity, objectification without appreciation, and a relentless drive to police the borders. And so I find the question for me on the personal level is, you know, if it's my desires that have allegedly led me, you know, to my politics, you know, to my my community building, my activism, my writing, but then I see the options, you know, in gay culture are so limited and so obsessed with those limitations. And I think one of the best examples in a way is if you just take a look at any kind of internet cruising site and the things that people say in a vast majority of the profiles, you know, they'll say things like masculine only, no femmes or fatties, or they'll say straight acting, straight appearing, or they'll have racial preferences. They'll say no blacks or Asians, or HIV negative, STD free, UB2. So it's these kind of like hideous, and these are normal. I mean, these are normalized, you know. They're kind of, no one questions it in general. It's just kind of, and it obviously, you know, gay culture has always had some of the same prejudices that exist, you know, in the larger world. But I think what's happened is that gay culture has stopped questioning those prejudices, and they've become the norm, you know. And so it's just think of the irony of a gay cruising site saying no femmes, you know, the sort of central symbolism of what it means to be, you know, a queer male is about being a queen and being flamboyant and outside of the norms of dominant society. And so that's sort of what I want to invoke. You know, that was the original vision of gay liberation was for, you know, a kind of faggotry that rejected, you know, the dominant culture, rejected, you know, masculinity, rejected the you know, the idea that you should have, you know, a sort of straight identity. And now gay culture is almost more obsessed with a straight acting identity than straight culture.
Well, let me ask you this then. Do you think that there was not always a section or an underlying sense of wanting normalcy in this movement, in the movement that you know, that has led to the space we are in today, because becoming normal was considered a victory?
Yes, I do think there was always what's
always. And I say normal in quotes, of course.
Yeah, yes, of course. I think what's always existed is there's been a tension in gay and queer cultures between a sort of assimilationist or, you know, a we're just like you kind of argument. And then on the other side, a more liberationist argument that, you know, said, well, we need to reject, you know, the sort of dominant signs of straight conformity. And I think what's changed. So, you know, that's existed for decades, that tension. But I think what's changed is that the sort of assimilationist side of the picture has actually sort of developed access to mainstream institutions of power. And so, say, 30 or 40 years ago, there were very few gay people who were out and able to keep their power. So everyone was sort of lumped in together and sort of required to depend on one another for some sort of, you know, self-sufficiency and ability to survive. And what's happened now, you know, we have, there are plenty of, you know, sort of gay power brokers, whether it's in the media, whether it's politicians, or whether it's business people, you know, whether it's David Geffen or Ellen DeGeneres. And for those people, you know, the things that mean the most are things like tax breaks and inheritance rights. And so that's what's sort of been positioned as the dominant needs of the gay movement. And so everyone who's, you know, on the margins, so, you know, like, say if you're homeless and you're on the street, you ran away from home because you're being, you know, beaten up by your parents, and you're looking for a safe place to express yourself, you know, in a sexual, to express your gender, to express your politics, the gay movement has abandoned everyone on the fringes, whether it's trans people, whether it's sexually promiscuous gay men, whether it's people who like to have public sex, whether it's queers of color, whether it's older queers or queer youth, you know, most people, queer immigrants, you know, people have just been abandoned.
Speaking of immigrants, there is one of the pieces in the anthology that you've edited is by Debanuj Dasgupta, entitled Transnationally Femme, Notes on Neoliberal Economic Regimes, Security States, and My Life as a Brown Immigrant Fag. It's hard for me to say these words on the air as a straight person, but I'm reading it. And Matilda, tell us the story written here, because here's where somebody who's living at the intersections of, in many ways, the margins, doesn't fit into today's picture of conformist gay culture.
Exactly. So Debanuj's piece is, I love, because it, you know, there's so many intersections in the piece. And so he sort of starts by talking about growing up in Calcutta, India, and, you know, finding himself involved in sort of gay organizing in the early 90s, and going to cruising parks. And he, Debanuj, you know, was an English-educated, middle-class, you know, gay person in India, and going to cruising parks and approaching coaches who are, you know, femme-identified fags, basically, queens, you know, and or third sex, third gender, and sometimes thought of that way, and, you know, approaching them to come to the meetings and thinking, well, I don't actually want these people to come to the meetings. You know, we don't speak the same language. They're too flamboyant for me. I'm a little ashamed. Mm-hmm. And then one time was distributing condoms in the park for safer sex and was harassed by the cops, actually multiple times. And it was the coaches who came to Debanuj's defense and scared away the cops. And so that was an awareness for Debanuj of, oh, well, actually, perhaps these are the people that are actually my allies,
right.
You know. And so Debanuj, you know, went to school in Ohio a little later and found himself in a relationship with a white guy, and the relationship was sort of that the white guy was the dominant master and Debanuj was the sort of docile Asian slave. And the obvious sort of like racialized connotations of the relationship were not immediately apparent in the sense of, you know, there was still like a satisfying sort of sexual charge. It was just that the relationship was so limited, and then, you know, Debanuj found himself ignored by that same person in public. And so it's, these are two stories, and then there's a story about going to New York and being in New York post 9/11, and as an immigrant, you know, South Asian person, in a relationship with a gay Latino man, you know, finding himself in this world of people who are really intensely targeted, both by mechanisms of state surveillance and also by mechanisms of, you know, common prejudice, you know, and violence. And so Debonair sort of weaves all that together to talk about the ways that immigrant, genderqueer, fags and queens and queers find one another and create community with one another that is sort of outside of these, you know, both the dominant vision of the mainstream gay movement and outside of, you know, white, middle-class, straight normalcy. Hmm.
Matilda, how much of what you edited, the anthology you edited and the piece that you yourself have written and your introduction is a rejection of the sort of dichotomies that people get placed into? And Debanuj talks a little bit about that as well. You're either documented or undocumented. You're either highly skilled or unskilled. And as you were saying earlier, you know, it's either one or the other on some of these websites. And that desire to box people, that desire to categorize folks, can be the death knell of creativity, of liberation, as you've said.
Absolutely. I agree entirely. Yeah, I think the book is sort of arguing against those, like, strict identity categories and instead, you know, talking about the sort of fluidity on one hand, and then also talking more honestly about, you know, where do we fail? You know, I think the sort of mainstream gay movement is so obsessed with this idea of success, and success ends up meaning cultural erasure. So how do we create something on the margins, from the margins and in the margins, that sort of challenges, you know, everything that we're supposed to accept as normal? And, you know, I think A queer analysis sort of positions itself, you know, in all these messy places, like messy intersections between, you know, race and class and gender and sexuality and nationality, desire, you know, intimacy, love, you know, all these things are constantly changing.
And how do you compare this movement to movements, for example, led by feminists, movements for racial equality, movements that have started out liberationist, started out creative? Have you seen a similar sort of drive for success, for quote-unquote normalcy, for assimilation, that have taken other movements down the same paths? And if so, are there lessons to be learned?
Yes, I definitely think, I mean, the gay movement is relatively new in comparison, mm-hmm. you know, especially to movements for racial justice and even feminist movements. And I think all of them have followed the same path, you know, of a very assimilationist agenda, ends up dominating. And so the lesson, I mean, I think we can take a look and who does that affect? Yes, it affects the people with the most privilege, but it doesn't actually impact people who are on the margins. And I think the lesson for me is we really have to stay focused on the margins, you know, not delude ourselves into thinking that, you know, a seat at the table of, you know, red, white, and blue normalcy doesn't mean that people are actually helped, you know, who are actually on the margins, who don't have that class privilege, that education privilege, racial privilege. You know, we really need to get back to fighting. And I think that's, again, to talk about, you know, early gay liberation was so much about people on the margins, you know, and I think that's what we need to be talking about it again, and specifically going very internally and talking about, like, our desires and our, you know, needs and, you know, where we fail one another, where we try for something that we thought was the ideal thing that we always wanted, and then it ends up destroying us.
Well, Matilda, let me ask you this. The ways in which gay culture has become accepted and assimilated in U.S. mainstream culture, even just looking at television and movies and Hollywood, you know, where it's visible now and considered, again, normal, quote-unquote, all of those desires for for example, ending the don't ask, don't tell policy in the military and wanting gay marriage. Do you see those as being parts of a wider movement, but parts that have subsumed the wider movement, but still parts that are measures of success, necessary measures of success?
No, I don't. I mean, I do think they have subsumed the larger movement. I would agree with that entirely. But I don't think they're actually necessary parts of a movement that matters, especially if we take the military. You know, gay inclusion in a racist, like, imperialist, perhaps the institution in the world responsible for the most violence is not progress. We need to be fighting for the end of the U.S. military.
What about marriage?
Marriage, I think, similarly, not quite as obviously, but marriage is still a central institution of violence against women and queers and trans people and children. And I think we need to fight for ending marriage. I think we need to fight the things that marriage can sometimes help procure, things like housing and health care, the right to stay in this country or leave if you want to, even love or a sex life, right? Everyone should have that. And I think the gay marriage movement actually makes it so that fewer people have access to those resources rather than more. I mean, if we were fighting instead for universal health care, I think for the last, the last 20 to 25 years that gay marriage has been kind of on the table, I think we'd be so much closer to having something that affects everyone.
And finally, how much of what you see today with the mainstreaming of gay culture is simply also corporate America's taking over, co-optation, which has happened to so many cultures, youth culture being co-opted, black culture being co-opted. Is this part and parcel of that? You were talking about the rainbow hummers earlier.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think, gay men in particular are seen as sort of the ultimate target market. And so there's this, illusion that is actually perpetuated by mainstream gay institutions that, single gay men make more money than anyone else. It's actually not true. I mean, there have been surveys that have been done recently that show that actually gay men often make less than their straight counterparts. But that illusion has been embraced, willingly by the dominant gay movement. And so, all the grossest aspects of consumerism, whether it's peck implants or, shopping at the hottest designer stores, wearing your Gucci loafers and, kicking homeless queers off the street, because they're getting in the way of happy hour. I mean, that's what gay culture has become. And I do think the wholesale of embrace of, corporate institutions is something that really needs to be rejected.
Well, Matilda, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and best of luck to you and all your events regarding this book. Best of luck with the book.
Well, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it.